Owing to a problem with the original recording, we join the speaker just a minute or so into the talk.
And it was constructed by being hung from the top. And therefore, as they started to tear it down, they had to tear it down from the bottom up. And as you can imagine, that's left the most extraordinary sight. It's hung around a central lift shaft, and we are now left with eight floors, or seven floors, hanging, suspended, off this lift shaft in midair. It's like a kind of giant game of Jenga, you might say. Only the city can manage it on that scale. Now, there was a period of time, I'm told, when in spite of the deconstruction of the bottom eight floors, there was one office still functional and operating on the 14th or 16th floor. It's looking out that way. The light was on. There was a bloke sitting at his desk. There were pictures on the walls, and the computers were running. Now, I suspect it was the site office. But the person who told me about it didn't tell it like that. I mean, he made out that the guy was somebody in insurance and hadn't quite realized what was going on around him and was blissfully unaware that the world had changed radically. There was a new future being constructed, and the way I was told it was this guy was coming in on the 8:45 every morning and carrying on going to work as if the whole of the future had not been upended. Now, our subject this evening is the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And I want us to see that the resurrection of Jesus, if it is true, if it happened, is a unique event that has radical implications and for a culture or for an individual to carry on as if it hasn't happened is a bizarre state of affairs. Really, I've just got two points, which we'll come to a bit later on. And the first is that the resurrection shows that Jesus Christ alone is Lord of all life. And the second is that the resurrection of Jesus shows that Jesus alone can give life in relationship with God. We'll come to them. I'll just touch on them, actually, at the end, but they are the two main points. What I want to do, first of all, is it's such a huge claim. You know, you can ransack the religious libraries of the world. You will not find a claim, I can guarantee it, on a par with this. You simply will not. There is no such claim of this level. It's such a huge claim that I want to spend quite a lot of time talking about evidence. Because if we're going to see things so radically changed in the way we see the world, we need to make sure we do that on firm evidence. Now, what I've asked Jude Mandley here to do is to read to us from the little blue John's Gospels. John was an eyewitness of Jesus. He was specially commissioned by Jesus to give us the facts of Jesus' life. And Jude, if you turn to the last couple of pages, Jude is going to read from the evidence of the resurrection.
So we'll be reading from page 57, which is chapter 20 of John's Gospel. And we'll be starting at verse 1, line 1, through to line 10. And that will be followed by a second reading on page 59, starting at line 24. So we'll begin John chapter 20, line 1, on page 57. Now, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early, while it was still dark, and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." So Peter went out with the other disciple, and they were going towards the tomb. Both of them were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And stopping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb. He saw the linen cloths lying there, and the face cloth, which had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded up in a place by itself. Then the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went in, and he saw and believed. For as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to their homes. And then skipping on to line 24 on page 59. Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails, and place my finger into the mark of the nails, and place my hand into his side, I will never believe." 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen me and yet have believed."
Thanks, Jude, very much indeed. Well, first then, the evidence. And I want us to see that the resurrection of Jesus was unexpected, that it was carefully recorded, that it was repeatedly predicted, that it was physical, logical, and credible. The evidence. It was unexpected. One of the striking things about reading all the accounts of the resurrection of Jesus is that his disciples, strangely, did not seem to expect it to happen. You know, sometimes you will have heard people say that the disciples just made up the resurrection to fit in with what they were expecting. But all the accounts of the resurrection of Jesus show us that and stress the unexpected nature of his resurrection. Now, you can see that just from looking at verse 2. So turn back a page, if you would, and verse 2 there, right at the bottom of page 57, where Mary says, "They've taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they've laid him." It's quite clear, isn't it, that she's not expecting him to be alive. Where's the body? And we find the same point again in verse 9, at the bottom of that paragraph, same page, "As yet they didn't understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead." And then if you look down to further down in the next paragraph, it's verse 13, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said, "They've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they've laid him." So it's quite certainly not the case that the disciples knew Jesus would rise and therefore made up the story to fit. Quite the opposite. With the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, all hope was gone. They gave up. And it was only the resurrection appearances that convinced them that Jesus Christ was alive. Look across the page to Thomas, and you'll see him there, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails and place my finger into the marks of the nails, place my hand into his side, I will never believe." It was the last thing in the world that he was actually expecting. But having seen him, they were convinced and everything fell into place. So it was unexpected. It was carefully recorded. What I want to do is just to reread some of the verses that Jude read for us just now. And I want you to notice the care and the precision of an eyewitness record. So take it from the top of page 58 and verse 3, right at the top there. "So Peter went out with the other disciples and they were going towards the tomb. Both of them were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came following him and went into the tomb. He saw the linen cloths lying there and the face cloth, which had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen cloth, but folded up in a place by itself. Then the other disciple who had reached the tomb first also went in. he saw and believed. Now, I have some friends down on Fleet Street. You may not think that's a possibility, but I have a lot of lawyer friends down on Fleet Street, and some of them are barristers. And when I read these accounts with them, even the skeptics say, it just reads like eyewitness material. But I want to push it even further than that. If you know anything about English literature, which some of you inevitably will, you have to say that either the gospel writers invented a form of literature that did not otherwise come into existence in the world of literature for a further 1,500 years, or it was eyewitness material. Let me quote from C.S. Lewis. You probably know he was professor of literature, I think both in Cambridge and in Oxford. Certainly held the chair in Oxford, not simultaneously. He went from one to the other. A bit of a coup, actually, you might say, for Oxford, but there you go. In the 1970s, he gave a lecture. I mean, he knew his stuff, so, you know, professor of literature does tend to know his stuff in Oxford and Cambridge. In the 1970s, he gave a lecture on John's Gospel, and he said this. I have been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, myths, all my life. I know what they're like. I know that not one of them is like this. Of this text, there are only two possible views. Either it is reportage, eyewitness material, or else some unknown writer, without known predecessors or successors, suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern novelistic, realistic narrative. If it is untrue, it must be narrative of that kind. And then he has this wonderful line, which you may not like. He says, the reader who doesn't see this has simply not learned to read. That's a kind of professor, isn't it, dealing with that. But if you want to hold on to the idea that the disciples made all this up and that this is a made-up account, then you have to believe that they invented the fictional historical novel over 1,500 years before it appeared anywhere else. The resurrection of Jesus is unexpected. The resurrection of Jesus is carefully recorded and repeatedly predicted. You may want to ask me about this, but Jesus did say over and again he would rise. The disciples just couldn't get hold of it until they actually saw him. But interestingly, for hundreds of years before Jesus walked the earth, the resurrection of God's King, the Christ, the Messiah, is spoken about. Now, I haven't got time to do this now, but I could take you to a Bible and back through the first part of the Bible, what's called the Old Testament, and I could go to 2 Samuel 7, to Isaiah again, to Daniel, to the Psalms, to Hosea, material that was written 700, 800, 900, 1,000 years before the birth of Jesus. And over and over and over again, running right the way through the Old Testament, you will find anticipation, prediction that the Christ will rise and reign on his throne for all eternity. It was unexpected, carefully recorded, repeatedly predicted. I want to say, though, at the same time, that it was physical, logical, and credible. Physical, that is, this is not simply a kind of spiritual experience, still less an hallucination. Look at verse 20, for example, there on page 59. He showed them his hands and his side. That's a physical event, isn't it? Look at verse 25. Thomas said, unless I see in his hands the marks of the nails and place my hand into his side, I will never believe it. Verse 27, 8 days later, Jesus came, he stood among them. He said to Thomas, put your finger here, place it in my side. This is no ghost. Any psychiatrist will tell you that hallucinations simply do not take place on repeated occasions with multiple witnesses in the way that we read of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's basic psychiatry. Jesus is physically risen from the grave. Physical. Logical. It's logical on two counts. Logical in that it explains logically the missing body. There is an empty tomb. There can be no doubt around the empty tomb. But nobody is able to produce the body. Now, those who wanted to deny the resurrection, the Roman authorities and the Jewish leaders, all they had to do if they wanted to scotch the rumours was to do what? Produce the body. But they couldn't. Instead, we have over 500 people who are prepared to be tortured to death rather than deny the fact that they saw the physical risen Jesus. Let me ask you, what is the most logical explanation? So logical on that level. Also, logical, if I may say, theologically. That is, Jesus claimed that by dying on the cross, he would carry God's judgment at your and my failure to recognize God as God. God's judgment at human rebellion against him is death, physical and spiritual. What happened to Jesus on the cross? God the Son died. If he paid God's judgment of death at your and my rebellion against God, what is the most logical next thing to happen? Resurrection. So the resurrection of Jesus is not only logical, and it's the only logical explanation of the missing of the body. The resurrection of Jesus is also logical and ties in with all of his teaching and all of the teaching of the whole of the Bible, that God, in his extraordinary love for humanity, would send his only Son, fully God, fully man, to die on a cross, to carry the judgment that you and I deserve for having rejected God's loving rule. And it logically, he has to rise if he has finished carrying that judgment. Physical, logical, credible. I love Thomas. I don't know about you, I love Thomas. This may offend one or two people. I don't mean to be offensive. I hope you'll take it in the way it's meant. I like to think that if we were portraying Thomas in a film, he would be a Yorkshireman. Now, if you're here from Yorkshire, you know, we're really glad you're with us. But Thomas would have to be Geoffrey Boycott, wouldn't he? You know, stubborn, dug in, he will not move come what may. He is the archetypal skeptic. And when he is told that Jesus has risen from the dead, and I won't try the accent, he says, unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails and place my finger in his side, I will not believe it. 8 days later, my Lord, my God. The evidence. Unexpected. Carefully recorded, regularly predicted, logical, credible, physical. On Sunday the 21st of January this year, a hunter in Florida shot a ring-necked duck. Believing the duck to be dead, he left the duck in his fridge at his home in Tallahassee. Next morning, his wife came down to the fridge to make her tea and get the milk out or something, opened the door, and Perky, as she has become known, raised her head and quacked. They rushed Perky to the local vet, which kind of strikes you as being strange, given that he shot Perky in the first place, but there we go. There was a change of mood, and they rushed Perky to the vet, and Perky underwent extensive surgery. Sadly, midway through the operation, Perky's heart stopped, and the vet and his assistant struggled to bring Perky round. She stopped breathing. Thump on the chest, manipulation of the beak, apparently, a little shock, and it all failed. And the vet turned to the hunter and his wife and said, I'm so sorry. She's gone. At that point, Perky raised her head off the operating table, started to flap her wings, and quacked again. Now, that is a little bit of light relief, but that is actually resuscitation, isn't it? This is not resuscitation we're talking about here. We're talking about the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And it's got big implications, big, big implications for us, for our world, for our future. Big implications. It means that Jesus alone is Lord of life, and it means that Jesus alone gives life. Thomas calls it right, doesn't he? Just look at verse 28. He says, "My Lord, my God." And notice what Jesus does not do. He doesn't say, "Blasphemy, how dare you," which a proper Jew should have done. He says, "Do you know, well done, you got it right. And anybody else in future generations who gets it right like you is going to be blessed. My Lord and my God, Jesus is Lord of life." You see, as I've said earlier, all the way through the Bible, God promises that he will come in the form of his Son, God the Son, the King, who will establish an eternal rule and kingdom. And that the one to whom he gives all of this authority will rule everlastingly. That he will deal, actually, with everything that spoils this world. And that he will establish an everlasting kingdom. And that every person who has ever lived will ultimately bow to him, whether they believe it or not, or whether they like it or not. And now Jesus, crucified, rises from the dead. It's the first day of the week. It's the beginning of a whole fresh start for humanity. In the early days of the deconstruction of the Crédit Agricole building, there was in the entrance hall a kind of scale model. You know, this was before they actually did it. And it gave details of the new Leadenhall Tower that's going to be constructed there. It was a picture, if you like, of a brand new future that was to come. And you could go in there and you could see, yeah, it's going to be 240 metres high and 8,250 stories and or whatever it's going to be. Who cares how tall? It's going to be big anyway. But you could see the future. And as Jesus steps out of the tomb and declares himself triumphant, Lord over death, Lord of all life, he gives us a picture of his glorious future with him as king, having overthrown death and established himself as the Lord and ruler of all. Secondly, though, Jesus gives life. And I want you just to look just very quickly at one other statement that you will, a couple of other statements you'll find in the bit that we didn't have read, and you'll find it on page 58 there, and right at the bottom, verse 17, Jesus said to her. Do you see it? Bottom of page 58, 1, 2, 3, 5 lines up. Jesus said to Mary, "Don't cling to me, for I've not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Now look over the page, page 59, and what is the first thing that he actually says to the disciples? Verse 19, just at the end of the verse there, he says, "Peace be with you." Not only is Jesus Christ Lord of all life, Lord of history, triumphant over death, Jesus Christ gives life. He gives peace with God. That's what that word means, peace be with you. And he enables the disciples to call the God and creator of the universe, my Father, my Father. That's pretty much unique, to be able to call God my Father, so that the God who seems so distant and removed, so sort of far away, as we come to Jesus Christ, becomes my Father. Let me speak personally for a moment. I didn't get started as a Christian until I was an adult. I'd always thought that Christianity was about being religious. I don't know, it's a very common thing. I thought it was about ritual and religion, rules and regulations, ticking boxes, and that sort of thing. And it was only when I was an adult that somebody actually took the time to explain to me that at the heart of the Christian faith is a relationship with the God who loves me. Loves me enough to send his only Son, God the Son, into the world to die on a cross, to carry God's judgment at my rebellion and failure to live for God. To open up the door, if you like, into a relationship with the living God where I can call him my Father. Let me say, when I realized that, it changed everything about my life. Gradually, it changed everything. And it was a bit like, one of those kind of spring days in May that come after a long and cold and wet and dank winter. And suddenly the sun, the clouds part and the sun comes out. When I realize that God loves me and that I can have a relationship with the God who made me and a place in his eternal kingdom under the rule of a loving Jesus who died for me. That then is the life that Jesus is speaking about. Now, as I close, let me say, you will not find that offer anywhere else in the world. So let me speak, touch on a couple of things. You know, Muhammad doesn't offer that. Gautama the Buddha doesn't offer it. He died aged 80 in peaceful serenity, surrounded by his devotees. Confucius doesn't offer it. He died in 479 BC, aged 72, in his hometown. Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Philip Pullman, your boss, the materialistic dream, the six houses, the vast millions in the bank, just doesn't offer that. They do not offer this relationship of love and intense closeness with the living God who made us as a forgiven person into eternity. Well, let's go to the 16th floor. What would it take to bring the person down? What would it take? I mean, imagine you had to nip up to the 16th floor today. I mean, I hope he's long since gone, whoever this bloke was. But imagine you had to nip up. What would you want to do? You want to sort of gently grab him by the lapels and say, the world has changed. Can't you see it? Take a look out the window. Have a look down. It's all different. Look at the model in on the ground floor. It's all changed. There's something radical that has happened. And look at the future that's prepared for you. This glorious new development and all the possibilities that it holds. Well, actually, it'll probably be pretty tacky, to be honest. But there we go. Let's not worry about that. The new Leadenhall Tower, anyway. But that's what we, I suppose, are wanting to help one another to see. That with the resurrection of Jesus Christ, it's all changed. It's all changed. And this world, with its separation from God, and with its everything that sort of wrecks it and spoils it, is not all there is. Jesus Christ rose from the dead. He is Lord of all life, and he gives life. Great, that's all I'm going to say. And there's questions now. The question slips on the desk, probably on the tables. Probably Paul will tell you about that, and I'll look forward to seeing them in a few minutes.
Perhaps I could break into your conversations at that point and pose to William some of the many, many questions that you've asked him. I'm afraid, sadly, in the time that we have, we're going to try and run for not much more than 20 minutes or so for this part of the evening, and then you're free to go, as it were. But that means we're not going to be able to get through all of the questions, I'm afraid. So please forgive us in advance for that. I've tried to select the most difficult, just to make sure, and a fair representation of those that came, just to make sure that William is duly scrutinized after his talk this evening. William, first up then, what is the proof that Jesus actually died? How do we know he wasn't a perky, as it were?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, can I ask you to take hold of the blue gospel that we gave you? No, that's fine, thanks. And turn to page 57. And you'll see that little middle section, Jesus is buried. Let me just read to you. After these things, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate he might take away the body of Jesus. And Pilate gave him permission. So he came and took away his body. Nicodemus also, who earlier had come to Jesus by night, came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds in weight. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen cloths with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. And then they went and buried him. Now, there's a lot of interesting points there. In Jewish law, any testimony had to be guaranteed, and it sounds extraordinary, but by two men. Nicodemus, we meet earlier in this account in chapter 3, and he is described as the teacher of Israel. So he was amongst the most senior in the religious establishment of the day, and therefore understood to be a trustworthy man. And Joseph of Arimathea was a wealthy enough man to own his own grave, which in the first century was quite a big thing to have. And so these two, you might say, oh, it was a big stitch-up. I have to begin to ask you how many different things you're going to have to believe if you want everything to be a stitch-up. But these two men came and dressed Jesus for burial. Now, in those days, you did dress people for burial because of the smell of death in a hot climate. And they buried people in tombs, in sort of open caves and things. And therefore, they covered them in spices and myrrh and so on to prevent the smell. And so it's not that these kind of guys, Jesus was put in there and they all ran away. They buried him. They dealt with him. And people in those days, then it weren't like us. You know, we're not used to seeing bodies. If you live in a culture like that, you see bodies all the time. And you're used to knowing when somebody's dead. In fact, look back a couple of lines, and you will see, page 56, Jesus' side is pierced. It was the day of preparation. And so that the bodies wouldn't remain on the cross, the Jews asked Pilate their legs might be broken and they might be taken away. So the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first, and the others had been crucified. But when they came to Jesus, top of page 57, they saw he had already died. Now the soldiers were executioners. They knew. You know, it wasn't like you and me. They were used to nailing people to crosses and dealing with them when they were dead. Now, look at verse 34. One of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and at once there came out blood and water. I am not a medic, okay? My remedy for all medical problems is TCP. So I am not a medic. But you medics, and there are some here, will know that on death, blood separates from the serum, and you end up with water and blood. Two separate sort of substances. That's right, isn't it? Medics? Anyway, that's what I'm... All the medics I know tell me that. John wouldn't have known that. He wasn't... This was before that sort of medicine. And yet he reports the soldier was thrust into the side and out came blood and water. So without knowing the medicine, John records the medicine. Again, it's another one of those things. I have to start saying, how many things... You know, how many strings does one start hanging one's argument on if one is not going to believe this is true? I have to start saying maybe you're beginning to believe an awful lot of things that are actually quite incredible. We'll go on.
William, thank you. Another, probably a quick answer to this one. Why does Jesus appear to Mary and disciples in a different physical form? Why don't people recognize him when they first see him?
Thanks. And there were a couple of questions on this. I think... the answer is I don't absolutely know. But his body is quite clearly physical and yet quite clearly different. And I think it is the stress, and it's actually rather a wonderful thing, that there is a continuity between this life and God's heavenly kingdom that Jesus rules over. Continuity. That there will be, Jesus talks about it as a renewal of the earth. When he returns to rule forever, a renewal of all things. So that there is continuity. I find that immensely refreshing. Most people think about heaven. They talk about heaven, they think they're going to be sitting on a cloud playing a harp, wearing a nightie. You know, to me, to be honest, you may think I'm a bit odd, but that does not appeal. All right? The Bible talks about God's new creation as physical, tangible, real renewal of this earth. And destruction of everything that spoils. And the fact of Jesus' physical but different body speaks of continuity and discontinuity. And I think that's why it is. Why don't they recognize him? I think it's another sign. They so totally don't expect to see him. It's the last thing in the world they're expecting. And then there is, imagine you have a pet chicken, it dies, you pluck it and put it in the fridge to eat, and the next morning you come down. You know, and it's walking around. You won't imagine that it's the chicken out of the fridge, will you? It's sort of so unimaginable that a dead thing can rise. Sorry, that may have lost you.
I've never thought of it like that before. But
Sorry, I'm terribly sorry.
I see what you're doing.
Dead people don't rise. And so it's so beyond their expectation that they don't recognize him. I don't think it's that hard to...
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Forget the chicken.
Some stuff on your point about it being carefully recorded and your point that it was either an eyewitness account or that it was this unprecedented literary style. What of those that say the eyewitnesses deliberately misled us, if you wanted to know about that?
Yes, of course eyewitnesses can deliberately mislead. But, and again, you know, I'm not a barrister nor a medic. Talking to my barrister friends, they read the eyewitness material of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Paul, and Peter, and they say this reads like eyewitness material. Apparently, the two things that would really make you smell a rat is, number one, if they were all identical. You know, if two witnesses stand up and their story is exactly the same at every single point, you know there's been a stitch-up, apparently in court, that's what they say. And the differences in the material actually show real authenticity to my barrister friends. I mean, I've got a barrister friend who came here as a rank atheist, really antagonistic, but started to look at the eyewitness, said, well, I'm a barrister, I'll look at this, I'm a thinking person, I'll look at it. Started to look at it, started to say, this reads like real eyewitness material. The other thing that convinced him, he gave his test, he talked about this in the Albert Hall the other day in front of 4,000 blokes, which was very brave of him. The other thing which really convinced him is that the eyewitnesses, if an eyewitness always comes off well in a stitched up testimony. And the disciples are very quick, like Thomas, to show that they were slow on the uptake. And that was another thing which helped him. What did they have to gain from making it up? I mean, Nero, you won't like this after dinner, but Nero took the early Christians, soaked them in tar, tied them to trees in his garden, and lit them as lamps. He wasn't a very nice bloke. What do you have to gain from making it up? Of the early apostles, history tells us, 11 of them died as martyrs. Some of them were tied to horses and pulled in opposite directions apart. Others were burned. Of the 500, many were fed to the lions. And you've got to start saying to us, now, read their accounts, and what do they argue for? What does the Christian faith stand for? Truth, integrity, honesty. What kind of twisted weirdo would make this all up, argue for honesty, integrity, and truth, and go to be strapped to a post in Nero's garden and used as a lamp? You have to start believing, if you don't mind me saying, some pretty extraordinary things before breakfast, if you're going to go on. I mean, you know, one of these things I might say, yeah, fair enough, yeah, maybe that, but time after time after time, you look at it and you start to say, hang on, I've got to believe that unbelievable. I've got to believe they made that up. I've got to believe he understood about medicine before he actually had medicine new. And you start saying, well, hang on, what kind of ground is my belief built on? And I'm wanting to say, this is solid material, what we're talking about here, and it's worth re-examining.
Thank you. I'm going to give you one more in evidence before we move on to the implications. Is there any evidence supporting the resurrection outside the writings of the 12 disciples?
Yeah, and I'm cautious here in that. I think it can be a slightly unfair question. I don't mean that nastily. I mean, I think it can be. I think we can ask for something which is unfair to ask for. Because if you examined the resurrection of Jesus Christ and realized that it was true, you couldn't provide evidence from outside because you're now a believer. So we've just got to be careful what we ask for on this level. The other thing, caution I want to warn you is sometimes you get over-enthusiastic Christians and, you know, we can be hopeless. We're so keen for you to, you know, to come to know the forgiveness and love of God that sometimes people get a little bit over-enthusiastic and slightly over-egg it. And I think that's, does that expression make sense? You know what I mean? They slightly make out that there's more than there is. Josephus does write, yes, about the Christians. And Tacitus, too, does write about the Christians and about this Jesus. And those things provide us with what you might call tangents, you know, lines into the circle of truth. I think it's unfortunate if Christians make it out that it's cast iron proof that Josephus and Tacitus wrote about it and therefore it must be true. And I think sometimes they mention the Christians, they mention that they claim that Jesus rose from the dead and Jesus is the Christ. Pliny writes letters about what are we going to do with these Christians. So there's plenty of external writing about the Christians and about Jesus, mentions. But they don't say, you don't get Josephus saying, by the way, Jesus was God, he died on the cross for our sins, he rose from the dead, and everybody ought to turn to him. You just don't get it. And sometimes I fear that Christians slightly sort of over-egg it. So I think that's two little warnings there. Don't ask for something that's unreasonable, because actually somebody who did get convinced starts arguing for the defense. So it's unreasonable to ask for. Sometimes Christians over-egg it.
Thank you. I guess some may have other follow-up evidence-type questions. Do come and grab William about those afterwards. Chat to people around your tables. Or come on that Christianity Explore course that William mentioned. There's plenty of time to work through the evidence in just a bit more detail than we can this evening, I'm afraid. William, a question about the cross. A few people ask this. Why was the whole thing necessary? Why did Jesus have to die and rise again?
Thank you. Let me come at it slightly from an angle. Do you think that if it were not necessary, God would have done it? So probably the most famous verse in the whole Bible is in this gospel, this account, John 3:16. God so loved the world that he gave his only son. Do you not think, have I put too many negatives in there? Do you think if it weren't absolutely necessary, God would have allowed it to happen? So what I'm wanting to say is that from God's point of view, because he loves us so much, that's why it happened. Why was it necessary? Well, from God's point of view, because of his intense love for us. God, that the idea of you stepping into eternity to meet Jesus as your judge, having rejected God, and deserving his judgment is so awful to God in a sense. He loves you so much that he prepared to send his answer. So from God's point of view, his love makes it necessary. From our point of view, from God's point of view, his justice makes it necessary. You know, wouldn't it be lovely to believe in the kind of God that some people believe in, is sort of, well, you know I haven't lived quite, done it right, you know, but when I get there, it'll be all right. You know, I square it away with my boss, and, you know, I used to pull the wool over my mum's eyes. I'm sure I'll square it away with God when I get there, and it'll be all right on the night. Well, now, if you believe in a God like that, who will just kind of bypass justice, mull on it for a moment. If it's all right for you, why shouldn't he make it all right for the next person? And the next person? And the next person? And you end up with a God whose judgment is either utterly arbitrary. He just says, oh, well, I'll have Andy here because I think he's a nice bloke. But when it comes to this person, Rory, over there, well, bad luck. Rosa, you're out. You know, that's just arbitrary. If he just says, oh, well, the person who's got 93% is in and the person who's got 92.5% isn't, what kind of God's that? And anyway, what kind of God is it who doesn't actually judge wrong? There's no justice. What would you make of God who said to the rapist, well, you square it away on the night, it'll be all right. What would you make of God who said to the people involved in the Rwanda massacre, well, I know you macheted a whole family, but, well, come on, boys will be boys. Now, God's love makes the cross necessary. He loves you, and he does not want you to face him in judgment. God's justice makes it necessary because he must judge wrongdoing. I've lived my life with God on the sideline. Again and again and again, he's been off on the sideline, and I've done things that I'm not going to talk about tonight, it's none of your business, but of which I am deeply ashamed. God must judge them, because if he doesn't judge me, he won't judge the Rwanda genocide person. He must judge. Could God, in his love, find a way whereby his judgment might somehow be settled satisfactorily within himself, so that justice is done and love is expressed? That's what the cross is all about. God the Son steps down, God the King, God the Son. He goes to the cross, he carries God's judgment in his body on the tree, so that you and I need not face it. Can you think of a love like that, or a justice like that, or a God like that? You won't find anything else anywhere in the universe like that.
William, thank you. There's a series of three or four questions here on the Bible. Could it have been translated after historical fiction was invented?
Can we take that one on its own? Answer, that's not the question, sorry.
That's the question.
You do your job, I'll do mine. Carry on.
Would that be okay?
Yeah, absolutely fine. I'm so sorry.
Seems a bit awkward. how do we know John's account's true? Why should I believe what the Bible says? Who are the gospel writers? I wanted to skip over those with your permission and just recommend this book, if that's okay. Which is called The Case. You can say whatever you like in a second. This is called The Case for Christ. I think there's a few of them for sale on a resource table, which is just on your by the door on your way out. It tackles the first seven or so chapters of this book, The Case for Christ, written by a legal journalist who started out life as a militant atheist. His wife became a Christian. He wanted to find out what it was all about, thought he would try and disprove it, get her back to the old woman that he'd fallen in love with, ended up himself becoming a Christian through his investigations, and recorded some of it for us in this book. So a lot of detailed questions that we just haven't the time for this evening about the reliability of the Bible's record are answered in this book. So is it okay if I skip past those and ask one or two about the implications?
Absolutely.
Do you mind
delighted.
That? Someone wanted to know, what does the resurrection mean for me personally? Why should I care?
Thank you. I wonder if you could turn to page 31. John 10:10. Page 31. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. And what Jesus is talking about when he talks about thief is false religious leaders and false philosophies. And when you think about the false philosophies that our world has suffered under, atheism and the extraordinary wicked damage that has happened through atheism in the last 100 years, wickedness on a level you cannot imagine. The thief comes to destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. What does the resurrection mean for me? It means that what Jesus did on the cross, this is a nasty way of putting it, but worked. He did pay for sin, rebellion. He paid God's judgment and he rose from the dead. It worked. It's like a massive kind of divine receipt stamp, paid in full. It's finished. It's done. And therefore the resurrection means for me forgiveness. And that means life to the full. Not just life now to the full, but life in eternity to the full. And those two things are very closely linked. You see, if you just believe that we're spinning around, there's nothing beyond this life, you're going to die, rot, and that's it, then the significance of every second of your life is diminished. If you believe that actually you are walking through life in relationship with your Creator, and that that relationship is going to last to eternity, and that He loves you intensely, and that He's interested in everything you do and think and say, then everything I do and think and say becomes of eternal significance. It kind of opens the door We don't just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. We live for God. And therefore the resurrection, because it means forgiveness, and because it means that Jesus is Lord of eternity and Lord of life beyond this life, it opens up, it just kind of throws open the curtains and opens up the possibility of an everlasting relationship with my Creator. What does it mean on a more practical level? It means that on a daily basis, I'm living with and for God. Now, you may not notice, I mean, you know, here I am, bloke in an odd red jersey and a pair of trousers, just like anybody else. But the level of significance that comes to each moment of the day, and I'm not saying it makes me sound sort of like a bit of a weirdo, but it just does give a whole new level of significance and meaning to your life if you're living for eternity. And if you're living to please God. I think that's... And then when it comes to kind of... So that's purpose and direction. You know, when it comes to being a husband and a father, okay, I make a complete mess of it. My wife's here, so I can't pretend anything that I'm not. But actually knowing that I'm forgiven by God and living in relationship with people who know what it means to be forgiven also means that you live in relationships that are forgiving and accepting. I mean, if you know you are loved by a God who is patient, merciful, generous, compassionate, loving, and kind, it does just produce, it doesn't make us perfect, but it produces the sort of characteristics that you find in God. Being part of a Christian family is the most wonderful, wonderful blessing I could ever imagine. And the community and love and selflessness, not perfect, that you find in a Christian family are, I think, unique.
Or church.
That's what I mean by... I meant in a church. Yeah.
Thank you.
I meant Christian family because we are brothers and sisters in church. Because we've got one Father, God.
Yeah. Thank you. Final question. I'm sorry that time's defeated us on the others. What about the people before Jesus? What happened to them?
Thank you. Well, I did ask to finish with that because I thought it was quite a... It sounds a weird place to finish, doesn't it? Why didn't I just leave that on the scrap heap? I said, Paul, we must tackle that at the end. The way back into relationship with God, we're told from the very beginning of the Gospels, is through what the Bible calls turning around and trusting God. The technical language is repentance and faith. Turning around, turning back to God, and trusting Him. So for any person to come back into relationship with God and to begin to experience all that we've been talking about requires coming down out of the 16th floor, or 14th, whichever it was, saying, actually, I've been wrong. I shouldn't have done that. Ignoring God. Turning round and trusting Jesus for forgiveness. And the Apostle Paul wrote about this, what about happened to people that came before Jesus. And he says specifically that those who had turned and trusted, what Jesus did on the cross will work for them backwards, if you like. And when you think about it, God operates outside time. He does something in time. The value of what he does in time, sorry, this is a bit of sort of philosophy, the value of what he does in time actually stands forever because he's eternal. And so those who were looking forward to God and his rescue, just as those who look back to God and his rescue benefit equally from the work of Jesus on the cross. So for anybody who turns and trusts, everything that Jesus did on the cross can be real. But if I reject Jesus, then the resurrection demonstrates, proves, in fact, that I'll meet him unforgiven as my judge rather than forgiven as my friend.
Could it really be anybody? And you said anybody who turned and trusted.
Yeah, and interestingly, we've been looking at this on Sunday night. You know, there's a woman who Jesus met in his very early, and She didn't know he knew everything about her, but he did, because he knows everything about everybody. And they got chatting, and it was one of those sort of evasive conversations. And halfway through the conversation, Jesus turns to her and says, I know that you've actually had five husbands, and the man you're currently with is not your husband. She was an adulteress. She was an outsider. She was not part of the religious elite. Who knows what had gone on in her life, what she'd done with herself, and what other people had done to her. The bloke she was with didn't love her enough to give her a stable relationship. And even so, he offers her eternal life. Anybody, yeah. Levi, the tax collector, even the tax man. Matthew's gospel was written by somebody who was a tax collector. They were renowned for being wicked cheats, dodgy businessmen, exploiters of others. Paul persecuted the early church. He was a fundamentalist bigot who slaughtered Christians, locked them up. He was included. So anybody who turns and trusts. Yeah.
William, thank you very, very much indeed. William's just going to go and eat his pudding now. So, but why don't we show our appreciation both to William and to the volunteers who have been helping us. I know you'd want me to thank them on your behalf. Thank you very, very much once again for coming. As I said, we run these evenings from time to time. Do ask the friends who brought you tonight to keep you in touch with things that we do here if it would be of interest to you to come again. Let me make mention once again of the resources table by the door on your way out. It might be worth taking a guest over there with you and buying them a book to take away and read or something like that. The people manning the table over there are helping me with the Christianity Explore course that William and I have both mentioned earlier on. You'll see this. Perhaps you could take one up now into your hand. There's a pile of these grey photocopied things on the table in front of you. And you'll see there details of times and dates of when the courses are happening. There's a few different courses happening, different times of the week, and in different venues around London over the next couple of weeks. Some in the room tonight have done the course. If you ask around, they could tell you how they found it. Hundreds, literally, over the last few years at St. Helens have done the course and found it enormously beneficial. And we would love to see you next Tuesday. We tend to say, if you can't make next Tuesday, don't worry, just come the Tuesday offer. Just come once if you want to give it a go and keep thinking about these things. Thank you very, very much once again for coming. You can stay for as long as you like tonight, or you can go as soon as you want to. Thanks very much once again.